Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Religious Liberties Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, May 6, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today we'll be discussing Town of Greece versus Galloway, the U.S. Supreme Court case regarding prayer in the public square decided just yesterday. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call, and also, as we typically do, we're recording the call for use as a podcast in the future. Should also mention that we had some technical difficulties today with our email notification system, so we've been unable to adequately advertise the call. So I don't think we have a great population of callers, but in any event, after opening remarks and maybe a couple questions by me, we will be turning to the audience for your questions, so feel free to weigh in with your questions when we make that announcement. We have one expert on our call today. She's going to give opening remarks of about 20 minutes, giving us some background on the case and then on the decision itself. But again, please be ready with your questions when we get to that portion of the program. Our expert is Kim Colby. She's a return guest. She did our Courthouse Steps version of this teleforum as the Town of Greece case was argued. She is the senior counsel at the Christian Legal Society, and we're very pleased to welcome her back. And with that, Ms. Colby, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dean, for this opportunity to discuss the important decision that the Supreme Court handed down yesterday, Town of Greece versus Galloway, in which citizens of the town of Greece, New York, challenged the practice of the town council of having members of religious congregations in the town, usually clergy, give invocations at the beginning of the town council's monthly meetings. Often these invocations included references to Jesus Christ and various Christian beliefs. The challengers were two citizens of the town of Greece who alleged that the prayers violated the Establishment Clause because of their sectarian nature. The town won in the district court, but it lost in the Second Circuit. The Second Circuit found that looking at the totality of the circumstances of the prayer practice, that the practice violated the Establishment Clause because the prayers were sectarian in nature and because of the dominance of Christian prayer givers. It's important to note that neither the challengers nor the Second Circuit claimed that any prayer at the beginning of a town council meeting would be a per se violation of the Establishment Clause. But it's also fair to say that the Second Circuit opinion clearly would cause most attorneys who are advising town councils that maybe they should just forego the practice because it was a very difficult decision to decipher. So yesterday, the Supreme Court, 5-4, upheld the town council's practice of having its meetings open with prayer. I think it's safe to say that the actual outcome of the case was expected by court watchers on all sides of the issue. The tenor of the oral argument last November had indicated that the prayer practice at issue was likely to be held constitutional. And after the oral argument, the main question was how the court would divide in its opinions and how broad the scope of the win for the prayer practice would be. In a short answer to those questions, before I go into a little longer examination of the majority opinion, the short answer is that the court divided 5-4. It divided largely along conservative lines, with Justice Kennedy siding with the conservative justices. I think the 5-4 split was a bit disappointing because at oral argument it seemed possible that one or two of the liberal justices might vote in favor of the prayer practice. The surprise perhaps was the breadth of the win. The language in the opinion is a very strong reaffirmation of the importance of religion in public life, and it's a very strong reaffirmation of the Marsh versus Chambers decision from 1983 that many had thought was kind of on its deathbed. In that decision, the Supreme Court had upheld legislative prayer by the Nebraska legislature that paid a chaplain, and it had been the same chaplain for 16 years, to give prayers. And often scholars have referred to the Marsh decision as an outlier, an exception to the Establishment Clause jurisprudence of the court. But yesterday's decision made very clear that Marsh is not an outlier. It's not an embarrassment to the court. Actually, one of the fascinating things about yesterday's decision was that all nine justices, whether they're dissenting or in the majority, agree that Marsh is good law, that it was rightly decided. And the only issue is whether Marsh allowed sectarian prayers to be given rather than simply non-sectarian prayers. As I said, the breadth of the win is a little bit surprising. Prayer at town meetings is permissible. That includes prayer that refers by name to Jesus Christ, his death on the cross, and his resurrection. Examples of that type of prayer are in the majority opinion. Now, as broad as the win is, the majority opinion does leave open avenues for future challenges to municipal prayer, and I'll discuss those in just a minute. But by and large, the majority opinion is a resounding win for invocations at federal, state, and local legislative council levels. Basically, just a quick overview of the five opinions that came out of yesterday's holdings. Justice Kennedy wrote the majority opinion that reaffirmed the vitality of Marsh v. Chambers and held that sectarian prayers, including those that refer to Jesus Christ, do not generally violate the Establishment Clause. Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito joined Justice Kennedy's opinion in its entirety. Justice Scalia and Thomas joined most of the opinion, but for his discussion of coercion. So basically, there are two main parts to Kennedy's opinion. He's holding that sectarian prayers do not violate the Establishment Clause. And he's saying that the reason for that is that they don't violate a coercive test understanding of the Establishment Clause. All five of the justices agree that the proper test to apply here is the coercive test. But Justice Thomas writes a concurrence that says, first, the Establishment Clause isn't incorporated, and he's alone in that part of his opinion. But his second part of his opinion, Justice Scalia joins and says that coercion is only found when there's an actual legal coercion to participate in the religious activity. That's not what Kennedy, Roberts, and Alito describe in their coercion test, and we'll get to that in a minute. Alito does a separate concurrence to address some of the specifics found in the principal dissent, which is by Justice Kagan. And Justice Kagan's principal dissent is joined by Sotomayor, Ginsburg, and Breyer. Breyer then writes a separate dissent. Kagan focuses on the fact that the prayers at issue, in her view, how the prayer practice is structured, kind of separates people according to their religious beliefs. It separates citizens' access to government by religious beliefs. And Justice Breyer spends his time in his dissent saying that he would have found the prayer practice at issue here to have violated the Establishment Clause because it did not reach out to include adequate representation for minority faiths within the pool of prayer givers. It's almost an affirmative action type of decision based on religion. In the next few comments on the specifics of Kennedy's opinion. Before I get to that, I want to highlight that all nine of the justices agree that Marsh is still good law. That is a big win because Marsh was actually originally a 6-3 decision. So we've picked up three justices for the constitutionality of legislative prayer generally. But what I'd really like to highlight is the fact that all of the opinions are rooted in the belief that pluralism and religious liberty are fundamentally essential to our free society. And that is a big deal because we're living in a time where there are many voices questioning whether religion is a good thing, whether religious liberty is necessary, whether accommodating religious beliefs is something that the law should do. I have actually heard people at a Harvard Law Symposium a month ago say that religious accommodation should not be allowed, that once the majority has decided what the law is, the religious believers need to fall into line with those laws, regardless of the impact on their beliefs. So it's very encouraging that all of the decisions here, dissent and majority, are in agreement that pluralism and religious liberty are essential to our free society. So let me move to Justice Kennedy's opinion. And to understand it, of course, there are three kind of background opinions, Marsh versus Chamber itself, which I've mentioned already. And the only thing I should note about Marsh is that it upheld legislative prayer 6-3, and it based it on the fact, largely, that the first Congress had had written the First Amendment and sent it off to the states almost at the same time that it started to pay chaplains to give prayers for the House and the Senate. And the fact that over the past 200 years, state legislatures had prayer almost unanimously, so it was a practice deeply embedded in our tradition. And then finally, that it really wasn't the place for courts or legislatures to be parsing what prayers are acceptable and what aren't. The problem with Marsh was that it dropped an innocuous footnote 14 that just mentioned that the chaplain in the Nebraska legislature had at some point, in response to a complaint from a legislator, had dropped references to Jesus Christ from his prayers. And based on that footnote, the Supreme Court, in its Allegheny County decision in 1989, the famous decision where a creche on the courthouse inner steps was held unconstitutional, but the menorah and the Christmas tree on the courthouse lawn was fine. That case had said, and also in a footnote, that Marsh had only upheld non-sectarian prayers. And so based on that, those two footnotes, there were challenges repeatedly over the last 15 years in the courts of appeals, some successful, some not, about whether legislative prayers were still permissible if they had sectarian content. And usually sectarian is code for ending in the name of Jesus Christ or having references to Christian doctrine. The third case besides Marsh and Allegheny that's relevant is Lee versus Wiseman, the 1993 case in which Justice Kennedy used the coercion interpretation of the Establishment Clause rather than endorsement, to actually strike down, unexpectedly, the practice of graduation prayer. And he had done so there, saying that even requiring the students to stand for prayer in a respectful manner was too coercive, and therefore the Establishment Clause was violated. So those are the three kind of background decisions for this case. So basically, there are five basic takeaways that I'd like to highlight about Justice Kennedy's opinion. The first, to borrow Mark Twain's quip, is that Marsh's death has been greatly exaggerated. The Greece decision reaffirms Marsh and gives it teeth. Sectarian prayer is not prohibited by Marsh, and the Allegheny County dicta to that effect was wrong. Second, related to that point, and perhaps most importantly, as I've already mentioned, pluralism is in, civil religion is out. Not only is this decision Marsh 2.0, it is also Zorak 2.0. Zorak, of course, is the case where Justice Douglas said that we are a religious people. And so this is a reaffirmation of the importance of religion in our society, that it can be acknowledged and not watered down for public consumption. Third, for all practical purposes, the coercion test is in and the endorsement test is largely out, although there was a little endorsement language in the majority opinion. Fourth, the majority opinion outlines some constraints that must be observed by government officials as they structure the space for prayer practices if they want to win future litigation. I would say avoid future litigation, but I think avoiding future litigation is impossible. The people who've been challenging these prayers for 15 years are not going to stop, but there are things that need to be done if you want to be successful in the future. And there are also some best practices that weren't required by the opinion, but might be good to observe in order to respect all religious citizens' liberty, because as we're seeing in the HHS mandate cases, the Christian faith itself is often a minority religion, depending on the part of the country or depending on the particular law in play. And so I think, you know, the takeaway here should not be a victory dance for those who support upholding these prayer practices. It should be instead a rededication to ensuring religious liberty and pluralism for all citizens. So going through those 5 points just quickly, the court's basic holding is that legislative prayer can be sectarian. It relies heavily on Marsh, and it says that the lower court's inquiry from now on must be to determine whether a challenged prayer practice fits within the tradition long followed in Congress and the state legislatures, in other words, the Marsh tradition. And interestingly, Justice Kagan, in her dissent, says she agrees that's the right question. The court's description of that tradition is that Marsh permits chaplains to ask their own God for blessings of peace, justice, and freedom that find appreciation among people of all faiths, that a prayer is given in the name of Jesus, Allah, or Jehovah, or that it makes passing reference to religious doctrines does not remove it from that tradition. And then besides this tradition aspect, this Marsh aspect, the court also relies heavily on the fact that if it did not allow sectarian prayers, it would be expecting legislatures and courts to parse prayer to decide what's too sectarian and what's non-sectarian. And in the oral argument, this is where a lot of time was spent in the oral argument, because basically the justices were trying to get counsel for the town to say when a prayer was too sectarian or non-sectarian, and it was very hard even to come up with that kind of prayer. Justice Kagan in her dissent says it's easy, but, you know, even a prayer addressed to a generic God or Father will offend someone who is a polytheist or a non-believer. And so Justice Kagan essentially would distinguish, even though she agrees Marsh is good law, and that it's the kind of matrix for deciding what's constitutional, she would distinguish it on three grounds here: that prayers must be more inclusive, that the town's invocations were predominantly sectarian, and that the town did not seek to accommodate non-Christians enough. The second main point I'd make about the decision is that the censorship concern that underlies Kennedy's concern about legislators and judges parsing prayer content so we're not going to decide what's non-sectarian and what's sectarian, that is the underlying theme of this opinion, that pluralism is in and civil religion is out. And I've already discussed this quite a bit, but it's a very important point that all of the justices view religious liberty as such a key element of America's free society. And it's very much a belief that, I'm quoting here, once the government invites prayer into the public sphere, it must permit a prayer giver to address his or her own God or gods as conscience dictates, unfettered by what an administrator or judge considers to be sectarian. And there's language like that throughout the opinion. And then also, as I said, there's also language that reaffirms the centrality of religion and religious institutions in the lives of many citizens, and the importance of religious institutions in the community, which in light of the HHS mandate and much of that litigation is very encouraging to see. The third point I'd like to make is that, as I've already said, the coercion test is what's in place here. There's one line in which the plurality gives a passing nod to endorsement and says, even under endorsement, a reasonable observer will understand this prayer tradition and not see that it's an endorsement of religion. But largely what the plurality is saying is that offense does not equate to coercion. So the fact that someone doesn't like a prayer or the religious content is not enough to create an Establishment Clause violation. So offering a brief, solemn, and respectful prayer does not compel citizens to engage in a religious observance. That's Kennedy's language. And perhaps the easiest way to understand what Kennedy has in mind by coercion is to look forth at the constraints that he mentions must be observed by government officials as they structure the space for prayer practices in order to avoid or win future litigation. It's a fact-sensitive inquiry that considers the setting in which the prayer arises and the audience to whom it's directed. And basically, it's looking for a, quote, pattern of prayers over time. So the court's trying to get rid of one or two prayers creating an Establishment Clause violation. But this pattern of prayers over time cannot include a pattern of prayers that denigrate non-believers or religious minorities, prayers that threaten damnation, prayers that preach conversion. These are all from the opinion. The prayer practice cannot betray an impermissible government purpose, which is not really spelled out too much. The town must maintain a policy of non-discrimination in its selection of prayer givers, but in response to Breyer's dissent, it's not required to search beyond its borders for non-Christian prayer givers in an effort to achieve religious balancing, because that would just lead to more entanglement with religion. I should note that here the town had said that it would allow atheists to give prayers, and it had invited a Wiccan priestess to pray, and she had prayed. Another constraint is that board members should not direct the public to participate in the prayers. Board members should not single out dissidents for disapproval, and board members should not indicate that their religion, the religion of the people, might be influenced by a person's acquiescence in the prayer opportunity. And this is a big part of Justice Kagan's dissent. And that dissent was joined by three of the other justices. And that's that when people come before a town council, they're often coming to have business permits or zoning matters adjudicated. There's a bit more of an adjudication process going on in town council meetings than in state legislatures or Congress. And so Kagan was very concerned that if a person is seen not to engage in prayer, but then turns around and says, you know, I want a change in my zoning on this piece of property, the fact that she didn't participate in the prayer will be held against her. And that, I think, obviously Justice Kennedy would be very likely to strike down something if that could be shown to have been caused by non-participation in the prayer. Finally, the town leader should not signal disfavor toward non-participants or suggest their community stature is in any way diminished by not participating, and town leaders should not review the prayers or provide guidance as to their content. So the bottom line is the plurality, leaves open the door for courts to review the pattern of prayers over time to determine whether they comport with the tradition of solemn, respectful prayer approved in Marsh, or whether there's real and substantial likelihood of coercion. But it's not impermissible coercion merely to expose constituents to prayer if they need not participate. I think that's a good place to stop, Dean.
All right. Thank you so much. As I mentioned at the outset, we had some technical difficulties with our promotional emails, so we don't have many callers on the phone. I'm going to open the floor to questions. I encourage people to ask questions. You shouldn't have any problem at all getting through to our expert today. So in a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for our expert today, just push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone while we're waiting to see who might weigh in here today. Let me ask the first question. You mentioned in your opening remarks that I think people on neither side of this issue were surprised at the ultimate outcome based on oral argument and maybe based on the briefs and maybe based on the reading of Marsh. Everybody sort of expected this decision. Does that go even to the level of who's on which side in terms of the justices? Were people surprised about the lineup at all? Was there some, you mentioned some disappointment in not getting a sixth or even seventh justice mm-hmm. in the majority. Mm-hmm. And then part two of this question is, were there any surprises in the outcome of the case, other than the basic outcome? Were there any surprises in the way the decisions were written or the opinions were written? Or?
Okay, so on the first one, in sitting in the oral argument, Breyer often gives you hope, and I'm going to start tracking whether he's just always giving false hope that he might provide an additional vote for kind of a pragmatic view of religion in our society. And so on this case, I had thought that we might pick up Justice Breyer simply because of the huge difficulties in parsing sectarian and non-sectarian prayers. It's just kind of a nightmare, and I thought that became very clear during the oral argument when the town's council, who's an excellent attorney, was asked for examples of non-sectarian prayers that would not offend anybody, and it was really a difficult question, and I thought it was pretty clear that it didn't have a real satisfactory answer. So in that way, I had hoped maybe to pick up Breyer for the pragmatic aspect. And then Justice Kagan had come out firing on all, I don't know what the right term is, all barrels of her gun or whatever, from the start of the oral argument. When the town of Greece's attorney stood up, I mean, she did not give him a second before she was saying, what if someone goes into court and there's a very Christian prayer before, you know, that the judge clearly agrees with before his or her case is being heard. And so that very much echoes what she says in her dissent. So in that sense, it's not a surprise. But she, I thought I had heard her say at the end of the oral argument, and I'll need to check the transcript, that after all this difficulty during the questioning of discerning a non-sectarian prayer that would be acceptable, I kind of thought I heard her say, well, we usually just get into trouble when we get into these cases. And so I had thought, you know, as much as she was passionate during the questioning that the prayers were unconstitutional, that maybe she had rethought as a result of just the difficulty in the oral argument. But obviously, that did not happen. Surprises in the lineup. Otherwise, I just was surprised again by Justice Kennedy's very strong language about just letting the prayer givers talk about their personal beliefs, and you know, there's these constraints: no damnation, no preaching conversion, no denigrating other faiths or religious minorities. But I mean, those are pretty, you know, basic civil discourse. And so I was surprised at how much he just reaffirmed the importance of religion in our society.
Does that those restrictions you mentioned are best practices? Does that seem to amount in your mind to a roadmap of how towns and municipalities can go forward?
It does. I think it's mostly, you know, I think the Justice Scalia Justice Thomas and his part of his decision that's joined by Justice Scalia, and all these decisions are relatively short and very readable, very accessible. You know, they are putting out there a bright line. If there's not actual legal coercion, anything can happen. And there's something appealing to that because this litigation, you know, it's draining for towns. And often, as we know, to avoid litigation, they just won't have the prayer practice because they're not required to have it. So I hope that this roadmap helps them to avoid problems, and I hope that the lower courts are, I guess, faithful in applying the sense of Justice Kennedy's majority opinion that these prayers really are okay. They're you know, very acceptable. They're even maybe good, and even sectarian prayers are okay, but. You know, Justice Kennedy, he's never been willing to have bright-line rules, and he always wants to be able to get at the case where he feels someone is being mistreated, and so he's, you know, left open those avenues. And lower courts may, you know, use those avenues to continue to make it harder than maybe it should be for towns to have these prayers, but hopefully that won't happen.
Again, if you have a question for Kim Colby today, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. A reminder, our Executive Branch Review Conference is being held tomorrow here in Washington, D.C. at the Mayflower Hotel, if you're able to attend that. In terms of upcoming Teleform conference calls, Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, our next scheduled Teleform call is going to discuss Bitcoin, trying to figure out what Bitcoin is and what it should be legally. In your opening remarks, you referred a couple of times to Marsh, the Marsh case, which concerned legislative prayer in particular, and then the distinction here, or at least one distinction here, the fact that this is a town council meeting, that more business is being conducted, that is, people that might attend these meetings might be bringing business to the town council and relying on them for a decision. I understand how the case came out in that regard, but was there an attempt during argument or in the briefing to distinguish Marsh from this, absolutely, saying this is just a different case, or was the real thrust of the plaintiffs to try and overturn Marsh, or was it a little bit of both?
No, you're right. This was the main way that the challengers tried to distinguish Marsh, was there's just so much more adjudication going on at the town council meeting than at the legislative, state legislature and Congress. Because, you know, when Congress holds hearings, I don't believe it opens its hearings with prayer. The prayer occurs in the legislative session where bystanders are just sitting in the galleries. They're not coming before Congress at that point with petitions or anything. So that was a big way that the citizens challenging this tried to distinguish Marsh, because, you know, they claimed clearly the people that are about to decide whether I get my business permit from my beauty shop are the people who just watched me stand there with my eyes open and upright, or watched me leave the room during the prayer. And so that, you know, that was a big point. And interestingly there too, even Justice Kagan in her dissent said, well, actually there's enough legislative type activity going on here that it does fit within Marsh. So she rejected that argument. I should say that, you know, I went through what, if you were keeping count, there were about 10 constraints that I feel like basically Justice Kennedy is saying, you can't do this, you can't do this, you can't do this, and there are 10, which is interesting. But there were also some things just mentioned in passing that might also be good best practices, and six of those that I counted, and that's one of them goes to this point, which is the board should schedule the prayer, you know, early in the meeting, and I think most of them do, but in a way such that dissenting citizens can either show up late and still be there for the business part of the meeting, the policy-making portion, or they can leave discreetly and come back. I mean, it should... egress and exit for the prayer part should be made simple. The board should, and the prayer giver should be clear that participation in the prayer is voluntary by saying that, you know. The prayer giver should face the board rather than the public. In this case, the prayer giver faced the public, and so that's okay. It doesn't mean that it's unconstitutional. But really, it would be preferable if they faced the board because, you know, Kennedy in his decision is saying this is really for the board members. It's to accommodate them. The prayer giver should not ask the public to stand, bow their heads, join in a common prayer, you know, such as the Lord's Prayer, or any other way that asks them to kind of participate in the prayer that's, you know, could be at all interpreted as, you know, peer pressure, I guess. And again, this wouldn't disqualify it under Kennedy's test, but it's just kind of wisdom, best practices. The board should make a sincere effort to contact all religious congregations in its boundaries to alert them to the prayer opportunity and make them feel welcome. This kind of goes to Breyer's concerns. And then finally, the weird thing about this is the board and the government officials should not be giving out guidelines for what the prayer should be like. That's a no-no. But at the same time, I can't believe that it would be inappropriate or unconstitutional for them to say, would you, before you give the prayer, you know, next month, would you be sure to take a look at the Supreme Court's decision in Town of Greece versus Galloway? And then the prayer giver kind of is alert to the concerns and can, you know, fashion his or her prayers in an appropriate way.
Mm-hmm. Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. The majority opinion or the plurality opinion, it sounds like, made a lot of not wanting to put the government in a position of writing or editing or approving prayers in advance, I guess concluding that that's an endorsement or an entanglement or, you know, that's perhaps a bad outcome. I'm wondering, did the dissent respond to that concern in particular? And if so, what did the dissents have to say about that?
Well, interestingly, I mean, it is very much something that Kennedy is against, and it came up in Rosenberger and Lee versus Weissman, you know, one case protecting religious speech, one striking down graduation prayer. So it's a major concern for him, and he sees it as an entanglement problem. He didn't see it as, you know, mention it as endorsement. But interestingly, I believe it was Kagan, it may have been Justice Breyer, but one of the dissenting opinions does say, really, to do this right, the towns do need to give guidance because in order to get inclusive prayers and an inclusive pool of prayer givers, the towns do need to give some guidance. But that's certainly not what the majority wants, and I think it would be a big problem. That's something that, unfortunately, it seems intuitively mm-hmm. correct, but it's a problem because of a lot of case law going back to Levy Weissman.
Right.
So that's one.
Interesting. Well, it looks like we don't have questions from our audience. I want to, you know, we've got a few minutes left if you want to express a final thought or wrap up for us.
Well, thank you. I mean, this has been really good for me to have to read these decisions or opinions and really try to put them together. It's, I think, going to be a very important decision going into the future. But I just wanted to reiterate, as happy as I am to see this decision, the fact that even Christian beliefs are minority beliefs in many sections of the country or in many legal contexts, as we're seeing with the HHS mandate cases, I think should make us really look at this decision and try very hard to implement it in a way that is respectful of those who are in religious minorities within a particular community. And, you know, that the big picture here really is that our country be one of religious pluralism and religious liberty for everyone.
Well, my thanks, certainly a lot of gratitude to you, Kim Colby, for joining us today. I appreciate your insights, and this has been a fascinating call. To the audience, thank you for dialing in, and apologies to everyone for the technical difficulties we had in our notification for today's call. Our next call, as a reminder, is Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, when we'll be discussing Bitcoin and the legal treatment of Bitcoin. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.